It's 1986, and I'm 11. This year stands out to me for many reasons. For one, it introduced the Cool Ranch Dorito, a coveted slumber party junk food for me and my friends who came over to watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Labyrinth, and Pretty in Pink, which all came out that year. I also remember the horrific Challenger space shuttle disaster. The spaceship blew up on live TV in front of every American kid, including me, watching at school with my classmates. And at this time, my Saturday morning cartoons were frequently interrupted by Ronald and Nancy Reagan's relentless Just Say No campaign.
Not long ago in Oakland, California, I was asked by a group of children what to do if they were offered drugs. And I answered, just say no.
That's Nancy Reagan. After her husband, Ronald Reagan, a former B-list movie actor, was elected president in 1980, his administration's Just Say No ads and PSAs flooded TVs and radios, urgently instructing American kids to stand up to drugs, just say no, and turn in anyone using drugs to the police, including your parents.
Today, there's a drug and alcohol abuse epidemic in this country, and no one is safe from it. Drugs steal away so much. They take and take until finally, every time a drug goes into a child, something else is forced out, like love and hope and trust and confidence. Drugs take away the dream from every child's heart and replace it with a nightmare.
In 1986, Reagan's Anti-Drug Abuse Act is passed. The act renewed the war on drugs and instituted mandatory minimum prison sentences for drug offenses, and maximum sentences ran to life. That year, my dad does a trip moving so much pot that if he'd gotten caught, he could have received a lengthy prison sentence under Reagan's new law. Now, this trip is a major success, but it's also the beginning of the end of my dad's career as a pot smuggler. Because like success, ripoffs are very common in the illicit all-cash world of smuggling. And following the biggest triumph of my dad's career came the biggest ripoff of his life. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter.
Things can...
I'm cleaning up around here.
Will you join us for the with your tea for this story? It's about Barbados.
In 1986, my dad is rolling along in his cross-country smuggling enterprise, and his personal Silk Road is a well-oiled machine. He's honed his skills, accomplishing smuggling success with his handful of trusted colleagues in Marin County in New York. Most Saturdays, he takes me and my little brother to the grown-ups' Mill Valley baseball game at the foot of Mount Tam in the crisp marine air. The ball game I mentioned in episode one, when I learned that most of the players were coincidentally also smugglers. Now, this game is where fun and business converge. During these ball games, my dad gets friendly with a player we're calling Baseball, a sparkly, cheerful art and theater enthusiast working in the same trade as my dad, but a different scene. Now, Baseball has around 30,000 pounds of Mexican pot coming in and needs some people to distribute it. Also, by the way, Baseball is the smuggler who coined the term savings and loan, the smuggler's bank.
He told me about this trip. It was a huge load of Mexican came in.
What is huge?
Well, 25,000, 30,000 pounds. That's big. Yeah, that's big.
So my dad teams up with baseball as one of his distributors and over 6 months smuggles over one-third of baseball's 30,000 pounds of Mexican pot.
My East Coast guy says, yeah, I think we can do a lot of this back east. We're using the biggest rental truck you can rent, 24-footers, and filling it with a ton at a time because there was really a lot of it.
Part of my dad's job on all of his trips, particularly bigger ones like this, was quality control. Raised by a professional art critic, my dad is a discerning connoisseur of everything, including pot, and he preferred to distribute quality pot. Now, according to my dad, great weed is aromatic, not full of shake or seeds, and comes in loose, fluffy bales, not firm, pressed bricks.
When you get that big, you've got to separate the good stuff from the mediocre stuff from the shitty shake. So after running out of all the good stuff, there were two other levels. And I remember doing one deal locally with the low-level stuff. And the guy bought 500 pounds for cash. And I made $100 a pound on it. So in one two-hour segment, I made $50,000.
Holy.
Yeah, which was
shit.
Cool.
This trip with baseball is the most successful of my dad's 22 years in smuggling. And he says it's the happiest story of his career, from the excellent colleagues he worked with to the slickness of the operation and how much money he ended up making.
To give you perspective on the whole trip, I ended up over 6 months selling 13,000 pounds.
Ooh.
Which was the biggest trip I had ever done. And it was so comfortable and easy. We got into this regular flow, which was fabulous, and didn't really have competition because we were one of the two big distributors of the whole thing, and they just loved it, and we were easy to deal with. And we, through that period of time, we made about $750,000 in cash.
$750,000 in 1986 is worth over $1.7 million in today's money. By the way, this is the $750,000 in cash my dad absurdly laundered in socks in episode 6. So, to celebrate the success of the trip, my family went on a fancy vacation to Barbados. We went on holidays fairly regularly to Cabo San Lucas, Hawaii, Jalapa, a remote Mexican destination for psychedelic pioneers and hippies. I see a pattern now. We usually vacationed in between trips with family friends, who, of course, it turns out, were also pot smugglers.
And so we had a vacation. So
yeah,
we celebrated.
Yeah, we did. We celebrated. So we booked this villa in Barbados for 10 days. It was, I don't know, 6 bedrooms, and it had a pool, and it had a chauffeur and a maid and a cook and several people who were always there working or would take you anywhere or would do anything. And it wasn't on the water. It was up on the hill above town, and we went there for Thanksgiving.
I remember eating flying fish every day, fried fish. It was delicious.
Right. The flying fish. And so they would bring in fresh fish that was just caught, and it was delicious. It was amazing.
I'll never forget this trip. One, because of its grandeur, but also it coincided with the appearance of Halley's Comet, only visible to the naked eye every 75 to 76 years.
So do you remember seeing Halley's Comet in Barbados? Do you remember that?
We watched it, right? One night.
By the pool.
Which was next to the polo field.
There was a polo field.
That big grass thing was a polo field next to that long pool.
Oh, yeah.
Halley's Comet has been recorded since ancient times and in civilizations around the world and has been associated with both good and bad omens, perhaps a foreshadowing of my family's approaching hardships. This family vacation was the last time we celebrated a successful trip, the last time my dad splurged on decadence, and the last time money came easily. It was the end of my family's monetary wealth and cushy lifestyle. Of course, my dad didn't know that yet. Nor did he know that he was about to make one of the worst judgment calls of his life. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. We'll be right back. So before getting into my dad's big financial misstep, let's go back to the Reagans. With the passage of Reagan's Drug Abuse Act, the stress of my parents' double lives was compounding. The Just Say No campaign flooded radios, TVs, and billboards across the country. I reached back out to Dennis McNally, our official counterculture historian, to talk about the Reagans and Just Say No.
To understand the Reagans, it's important to go back a little bit. In 1966, he ran for governor of California, and he ran in various subtle ways on a platform attacking the students at Berkeley who had had the free speech movement in 1964. He conflated the students at Cal Berkeley with hippies, and said that his famous line was that hippies were like, they had hair like Jane, talked like Tarzan, and smelled like the chimp, what a cheetah, whatever it was called. Secondly, he ran an anti-black campaign against the people who had rioted at the Watts riots in 1965. And that is what got him elected.
This is the platform that got Reagan elected California governor in the 60s and U.S. president in 1980.
Nancy Reagan had these extreme pretensions to the real social upper class, to the old money that in some ways still runs America. And one of the side effects of that, and holding over from his opposition to Cal Berkeley and the free speech movement, was Just Say No. The impact of Just Say No was simply to lump all drugs together. And so anybody that had anything to do with drugs, no matter what the drug, was going to get as much time as the judges could figure out to give them. It harshed everything, and you didn't want to get caught.
Much of Just Say No and the Anti-Drug Abuse Act was targeted at crack and cocaine, but as Dennis said, all drugs and drug users were lumped together as one melodramatic evil. The Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986 required a minimum sentence of 5 years for drug offenses that involved 100 kilos of marijuana, plus a minimum sentence of 10 years for drug offenses that involved 1,000 kilos of marijuana. Now, 100 kilos is roughly 220 pounds. 1,000 kilos of pot is over 2,200 pounds. With the 13,000 pounds my dad had just smuggled, he could have been sentenced to decades under the new law. So one thing we've done this season is show the fun side of disorganized crime. Because my mom and dad remember their past truly with the glass half full. They're fun and funny people, and there's always a ridiculous twist to their stories.
That was totally interesting, Mom.
Because got the flavor, though.
My mom and I recently visited with one of her old girlfriends whose brothers were busted. And on the drive home, my mom began having revelations.
Yeah. You said you had a plan B. What was your plan B?
I have to remember, you know, I had passports and money put away to go to, I was just going to go to Europe, you know. You could do that then because there was no digital.
Did you have, like, passports in different names?
Yeah.
Different names?
Always, yeah.
Who made the passports?
This guy that I knew, he was, like, this really sleazy counterfeiter.
Oh, my God.
In L.A.
Where are those passports now?
Oh, we burned everything, you know, way long time ago.
You burned it?
We didn't sell them. We burned them. They evaporated somehow, you know.
They evaporated? That's not possible.
That's one of our terms for losing. It's evaporated.
So this podcast has brought up a lot of repressed memories and emotions within my parents. And it was cathartic for my mom to remember she'd suppressed a ton of fear and stress over the years, raising kids and hiding the business. She told me more while she was watering in the garden.
The stress of being, yeah, but I was trading it in. I would rather be comfortable than in poverty and have to keep my mouth shut, you know. I'd rather be comfortable and have another identity.
Once, with her doctor, my mom just revealed what was going on at the house. It was too stressful to hold it in.
I don't know, something about it, I just, like, blurted it out. Like, there's so much weed around, it's just, you know, there's 100 pounds in the basement, and I'm freaking out. And he said, oh, that's what's going on. It's hard to keep secrets. I'm trying to think if there's any girlfriends that knew my secrets. I don't know. Couldn't talk to a therapist around here that can't keep any secrets in Marin.
Under the Reagan administration, people were getting busted for pot and going to jail in alarming numbers because cannabis laws were draconian. In 1988, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act was enhanced, which doubled down on policies to create a drug-free America. As a result of these laws and the impact on the drug-smuggling community, my parents were under enormous stress. More stress than ever before. And according to scientific research, stress and decision-making are a terrible combination. To understand this further, I called my dad's friend, psychiatrist and neuroplasticity expert, Dr. Michael H. Moskowitz. Now, he's been working in public health and medicine for almost 40 years. I used to babysit his kids when I was a teenager, driving to my job in the car given to me when I turned 16, a giant American former pot smuggling boat of a vehicle. I was so embarrassed to drive it.
So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the effects we see in people's behaviors is that they become less effective in problem solving, planning, executive function, all those types of things. And that means that when people are stressed, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to say and do things that they don't really mean, but then now they have to own them. They're going to really not function in an optimal way. But when that stressful chemistry gets trapped in that area of the brain, it shuts off the other parts of the brain that we use to reason and do other things so that we can make a decision to do what has to be done and not weigh it over and think about it and run it through a lot of different processes.
What about, what are your thoughts on people making financial decisions in stressful times?
Well, if you can avoid it, you should avoid it. Unfortunately, those decisions sometimes come up and force themselves on people. I would say in that circumstance, it would be great if people just kind of stepped back before they made those decisions, did some deep breathing, if they knew meditation, to meditate a little bit, just really try to get themselves calmed down and slow everything down before they make those decisions, because the fireworks going off in their brain is really going to make it hard for them to make a decision that's rational and will hold up.
Yeah, awesome. I read that in the psychology, one of the journals, that they discovered people, when under stress, sort of ignore the negative outcomes of a situation and focus on the positive outcomes.
Yeah, it's true. And it's one of those things that involves a bunch of different chemistry in the brain and different regions of the brain that are being lit up and set off. We have a reward center deep in our brain that is good on most things, but when people are in a stressful situation, it tends to shift over to more addictive and compulsive behaviors than healthy ones.
So feeling stressed changes how people weigh risk and reward. When under stress, people pay more attention to the upside of a possible outcome. The research found stress makes people focus on the way things could go right instead of wrong, and start paying more attention to the positive information and discounting negative information. So, when stressed out people are making a difficult decision, they may pay more attention to the upsides and less to the downsides. So that is perhaps why my dad ends up putting his trust in the unscrupulous hands of the wrong person. Stress is one factor. Also, my dad's rising star could have made him feel invincible. Regardless, who knows? But cue the Green Beret. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. We'll be right back. So after we return from the family vacation to Barbados, my dad feels a lot of pressure to clean his money. So he buys some wine, his money laundering investment of choice, but he's on the lookout for other investment opportunities because $750,000 is a lot of money to launder.
Is this the most cash you've ever had? So
of
now
my own. Yeah,
you're
the most
facing
cash of my own, and
oh,
it's
so you're
stashed.
Facing, what do I do with it? How do I launder this money?
Among other things, yeah. Back then, so I'm feeling, oh my God, I've got all this money, I've got to do something with it. I don't know why I felt so pressed to do anything with it, but just be for a while.
I was thinking too quickly and not just appreciating being where I was.
I met one of your classmates' fathers one day in a carpool. This is the Beret.
The Green Beret.
The Green Beret. And he was driving a Mercedes, I think, mm-hmm. at the time. And
I meet up with this guy who starts to smooth talk me. And I'm going to need a break here first before I get into this.
Yeah, it's a rough story.
Yeah, so you should
schmutz it off.
Take a break for a minute.
Now, this story is challenging for my dad to tell. He's still angry about it, towards the Green Beret, but also towards himself. Because as he sees it, his unfortunate financial choice put his family in jeopardy and everything on the line. So let's go back to the beginning. It all started when I made a new friend. When I was in fourth grade, a new girl joined our class. An only child, she lived with her glamorous mom, who wore sparkly makeup every day, unlike most of the artsy hippie moms who only wore makeup on special occasions. By fifth grade, I became good friends with the new girl, and her single mom's townhouse became a favorite slumber party location. We didn't have to share the TV with any siblings. She lived near the mall, which we were allowed to explore on our own, and her mom would get us junk food that none of the hippie moms would ever consider. The new girl was super fun, kind, and joyful, and she loved giving everyone makeovers and crimping our hair with her cool 80s crimping iron. I'll call her Chipmunk. Eventually, Chipmunk's gruff, sunglass-wearing, chain-smoking dad moved to the area, and Chipmunk split her time between her parents' condos. This was the Green Beret.
All right, you got your third cup of coffee for this one, huh? I love it.
I was making a lot of money fairly quickly and regularly, so I sort of was now on the lookout for where to put it. Like I needed to put it anywhere other than where I should have left it. We had run into each other somehow. So what I remember more than anything, I don't remember what we talked about other than to say, he said to me, I'll show you how to make real money.
Chipmunk's dad was also not an artsy hippie. He said he'd once been a special forces operative, hence the alias. Square and stocky, he looked like a meaty Germanic refrigerator, and he constantly smoked cigarettes, which was unusual amongst my friend's parents. He always wore prescription sunglasses, even inside. His eyes were rarely visible. And unlike Chipmunk's vibrant mom, he didn't seem to like kids. He was imposing, grumpy, and casually racist, stewing, simmering in a miasma of cigarette smoke. In retrospect, my dad and I realized he was kind of like Darth Vader.
He's almost like, I think he had a vibe of like the dark, like Star Wars Dark Empire.
It's true.
Yeah, he was hypnotic.
He was seductive.
Like, villainously, he was very right. Star Wars villain hypnotic. Why are people all around Darth Vader doing his bidding?
Now, however, even though Chipmunk's dad definitely hadn't been a psychedelic pioneer and he wasn't remotely artsy or intellectual, he was a good talker. A really good talker. And my dad and Chipmunk's dad seemed to hit it off in some weird way. Soon it appeared that they were doing business together. And just like me and my friends didn't really know what my dad did for a living, we also didn't know what Chipmunk's dad did for a living. But it didn't matter, because we didn't care. We cared about the MTV Countdown, 16 candles, and scoring Kraft macaroni and cheese, all of which were provided at Chipmunk's house. And my dad doing business with Chipmunk's dad was great for me, because Chipmunk and I got to spend even more time together, which was always super fun.
Real estate?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, he was doing development. He was doing deals.
My parents have explained to me what they understood the Green Berets' supposed business ventures to be, and it's still somewhat confusing, which is what he was aiming for. Here's my mom's take on it.
What kind of power did you see him have over Dad?
He could hypnotize people and assure them that he was, like, divinely guided or something. In business, like, he knew what was... And he'd explain these really weird schemes, like, and you wouldn't understand what he was saying about, you know, different transactions you do with the bank. Because the bank was trying to put him in prison because he had gotten caught in Hawaii. Peace, love, hippies, he was in the perfect place. Because first he tugged at our heartstrings.
Oh.
With this bank trying to put him in jail, you know, this bank thing. And so we believed him. He didn't do anything. I think what the Green Beret scam was, you would find a teetering company like that was having a hard time getting funding, and he'd talk them into selling it to him for a legal letter from the bank saying they would back it.
So they would have this company that on the verge of collapse and do well with it.
They would find a naive investor like Walter, and then he would just pump him up with, like, oh, this company can really do great because we have this company, and then we have this rock company over here, and this chalk company here, and this borax company there, and we'll go squeeze shale for more oil, and we'll put them all together, and there'll be a combination, and... And you were, like, caught up in it, you know. We would just only be part of a scam. It was all pyramid, like weird pyramids.
So Chipmunk's dad portrayed himself as a big-time developer with real estate opportunities across the country, and he operated a confusing pyramid-like scheme, scamming businesses and investors out of money. And he started his scam by tugging at my trusting, empathetic parents' hippie heartstrings.
I spent months living in Palm Springs with him off and on in 86.
Wow.
In 86, I was down there a lot trying to get this deal. And again, it was another deal of assets that had been impossible to develop. But it was huge. I can't remember how huge. I mean, could have been a couple of million acres.
Holy cow.
Yeah, yeah. He was into mining in Colorado at one point, and we were into mining in Mississippi. We had some kind of I don't know what it was, gravel or some such thing, among other things.
To assure his investors, i.e. my dad, the Green Beret would hand over some of his own assets as collateral. For one of their deals, he handed over a supposed Van Dyck painting to my parents. Now, it may have been authentic, but knowing now what we know about the Green Beret, I can only assume if the Van Dyck painting wasn't a forgery, it was stolen.
There was a time at which, like a fool, I even had in my hands what was supposed to be a Van Dyck painting. It's probably 10 feet tall. and I had it in a a specifically climate controlled locker in New York that kept artwork.
So he was into art? Because I thought
he was into all sorts of he was into anything that he could use leverage on. Basically, his deal was to use assets that were not as valuable as they could appear to be. To leverage against loaning money is what I think, as I look back. He was in any place he could scam where the dollar, you know, where the numbers were hitting seven or eight figures.
The Green Beret kept pitching my dad on enticing projects that he promised would reap in a ton more money for my dad. Plus, it would come back clean. So my dad, hypnotized by the Green Beret's slick talk and under immense stress, continued to believe that positive outcomes would materialize. And Dad kept investing in Chipmunk's dad's deceptions.
He would suck it out slowly, 50 grand at a time, for one thing or another. And it happened over a prolonged period of maybe a year or more.
After middle school, me and Chipmunk went to the same private college prep high school in Marin. It's the late 80s, and things start to go downhill between our dads. At some point during my high school years, my parents begin to hate the Green Beret, like really loathe him. Clearly, a business deal had gone wrong between them, but I didn't know the details. After high school, Chipmunk and I drifted apart, and while we reconnected in our adult years on social media, we're old friends rather than close friends. Part of the reason is because I've always known that her dad, in some way, stole money from my dad.
It was always, a deal is going to be closed Tuesday or Friday. That was the song. You could almost make up a song about him called Tuesday or Friday. Because next Tuesday, it's going to close and all this money is going to go into... I mean, it was like... It was this mantra. But I would constantly bug him about deals. I mean, I realized probably, I don't know, within the year, obviously, but I stayed in touch for years and years to, you know, waiting for the big hit. I don't know what I was hoping. I mean, I really have trouble putting my head back into that headspace now, because all I can, the headspace goes to what a dumb shit I was. Okay, I mean, why not 100 grand and say enough already? You know, it's, so I can't even quite, greed, back to greed.
Did you make any money off of the Green Beret?
Money off of, no. It was a one-way street all the way. The bigger the money, the bigger the sharks. Mm. That's the nature of life. Mm.
My gullible, adrenaline junkie, money-obsessed, psychedelic pioneer dad. His work in the smuggling world was done primarily in good faith. Deals done on handshakes between largely honest counterculture outlaws. So Dad approached the street world to clean his money in the same way, which ultimately was foolish, because not everyone is honorable and ethical. As Dad's attorney, Bernie Siegel, said in the late 80s, the quality of the criminal has gone downhill. Now I understand, Bernie was talking about people like the Green Beret, a dishonest criminal and shameless con man. Different from a psychedelic outlaw.
Was there paperwork between you?
No. What he knew, it's real simple. He knew that I could never do anything to him because it was illegal money.
Did he know you were a pot smuggler?
Clearly, he was clear about the fact that he could just continue sucking money until I would stop giving it, and there would be nothing I could do about it because I couldn't go to the police.
There was never closure. There was never
a... Oh, fuck no. He just sort of disappeared and would never talk to me. You know, and if I wanted to, I could chase him and find him easily. For what purpose? To spit in his face? It wasn't worth the energy.
In total, my dad ends up giving the Green Beret $550,000.
Do you remember ever, like, telling Dad to not give any more money to the Green Beret?
Oh, yeah, I went over there one day and I said, don't you take any more money from Walter. We tapped out. Just leave us alone. And then that afternoon, Walter went over and the Green Beret got Walter to sign over this Van Dyke painting that was in our storage unit in New York City.
This painting is the collateral the Green Beret had given to my dad. And my dad unfathomably gives it back to him. It's like he was under Darth Vader's power.
It was like some kind of like weird collateral they were moving around. It was a hot Van Dyke painting, and I saw it once. We went to the storage unit and saw it, and it was supposed to be, you know, an asset for us in case they didn't pay us back. So the Green Beret was like a con man. He was fast. He had Walter hypnotize to do his bidding.
Okay, so Reagan wants pot smokers and smugglers to rot in prison, and my dad's overburdened neurons are firing, causing him to potentially focus solely on positive outcomes. The lucrative deals the Green Beret promises will close on Tuesday or Friday, resulting in clean cash for our family to live on. So my dad, under the extreme stress of working in an extremely high-stakes business, under attack from the federal government, supporting a family of five, trusted the wrong person, made a bad decision, and gave $550,000 to the Green Beret, believing he would be true to his word, launder the money, and return it to my dad. Well, that never happened. Every good con man has a great show. Just like my dad was excellent at his job as a pot smuggler, the Green Beret was excellent at his job as a first-class A1 grifter and thief. Big wins are often accompanied by big losses. Easy come, easy go. It's a cliche for a reason. The grifter stole from the perfect victim, a counterculture outlaw who couldn't go to the law for justice, and he wouldn't stoop to violence. Shit happens, and how we deal with it informs one's daily joy and contentment. My parents are big on letting things go, not dwelling on the past, focusing on the positive. Easier said than done. After my dad loses $550,000, my family begins our slide into a lower economic class. And as the late 80s march into the early 90s, Reagan pours a ton of money into the Drug Enforcement Administration, and my dad's colleagues start getting busted or fleeing the country. As money's getting tight, my dad starts selling off our family's assets, and me and my siblings begin an unwitting adjustment to a life of financial stress. But the worst consequence of the Green Beret's audacious theft was my dad's gradual descent into a years-long depression, ignited by a sense of failure to his family and bolstered by his childhood of constant criticism from his father. My dad wore a melancholy coat of shame and self-loathing for years to come. The Green Beret's torch of deceit lit a slow-burning, long-lasting fire of guilt, remorse, and embarrassment within my dad, which 30 years later is finally waning. What lesson can I learn from this debacle? Well, don't assume you know who your parents are, where they come from, and what they're dealing with. Be aware that insecurity, greed, and hubris are human and lead to downfalls. And be mindful of naivete, thinking all people have good intentions. The assumption that all people are honest and good is a dangerous expectation in a world of resource inequality. Survival is based on resources, and the struggle for resources is as old as the origins of life, which, by the way, are single-celled microorganisms known as prokaryotes, whose energy came from carbon and sunshine almost 4 billion years ago. Well, my dad's energy, in the form of $550,000, was lost. Thankfully, he remained a free, honest outlaw under the radar of the federal government. The Green Beret is the tip of the misfortune iceberg, with his ominous negative energy setting the wheels in motion for a string of terrible developments. Coming up in the next episode, I talk with a pot smuggler I've known since I was six, who went to a federal prison for years. And we'll hear about close associates of my parents whose family was torn apart when one brother is sentenced to 10 years in a federal prison and the other becomes a fugitive. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter. Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter is written and recorded by me, Rainbow Valentine. Our producers are Gabby Watts and Taylor Church. Executive producers are Brandon Barr, Brian Lavin, Elsie Crowley, and me at School of Humans, and Connell Byrne and Charles Bryant at iHeartRadio. Our music is by Gabby Lala and Claire Campbell, with original theme by Mark Caron and me. You can follow us online at disorganizedcrimepodcast.com.
Writing our own story, do it as we please. Tamil pies, sleeping princess of the redwood trees. She helps us keep it real. A handshake seals the deal. Grab the stash, seal the meal, and load up these old wheels. Rolling a doobie, young, rich, and groovy. Making it up as we roll along.